501 years ago, the first stone was laid for the new St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. In her latest book, R.A. Scotti explores the history of the basilica's planning and construction, a process which took 200 years and was overseen by an ever-changing cast of popes and architects. Basilica, the Splendor and the Scandal, Building St. Peter's, is now available in paperback from Plume Books, and I'm very pleased that R.A. Scotti could join me today on the show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
What got you thinking about the history of St. Peter's design and construction?
I was in school in Rome when I was about 19, and I was fascinated by the basilica. And ever since then, I've really wanted to do the book, but it's such a complicated and involved story that I didn't think I was ready to tackle that bigger topic until recently.
Hadn't your father become friends with Pope Paul VI?
Yes, my father was at the University of Rome in medical school during Mussolini's time, and Pope Paul was then a young Monsignor who was the chaplain of an anti-fascist student group, which my father belonged to, and they became lifelong friends. He used to come, when he would come to this country on trips, he would always call, and we met him several times. He was a wonderful man.
But that didn't give you access to any of the things that you might need for research?
No, he was, you know, long dead.
Today, St. Peter's stands on the ruins of the original St. Peter's, which was built by Constantine 1,200 years before. What role did Constantine's basilica play in the rise of Christianity?
Well, that was it was actually the second basilica, Christian basilica, that he built. The first was the original St. John Lateran. And he built it over the spot where they believed St. Peter's was buried. He was crucified upside down there, right under the original St. Peter's, and that became the most holy shrine in Europe.
So it must have been pretty shocking when Julius decided to get rid of it and build a new St. Peter's.
That's why I called the book The Splendor and the Scandal, because it was a sacrilege. It was just the most scandalous thing that Europe had ever heard, that they were going to tear down this old basilica and build a new one.
Was the old basilica in bad shape at that time?
It was in bad shape. It had, over the years, various popes had added chapels and aisles and all, and it was listing quite badly. The roof was in disrepair. Various changes had been made in it, but nonetheless, no one wanted to tear it down.
But Rome itself was pretty squalid at the time, wasn't it?
Rome itself had fallen into terrible ruins. The popes had moved to France, and without the church centered there, there was no real reason for Rome to be, and so it fell into terrible disrepair. It was almost like a sewer.
But then the decision was made to revitalize Rome and to make it once again the seat of the Catholic Church.
Yes, the first pope to begin that was Nicholas V, who moved the papacy back to Rome, but it took another almost 100 years before it really began to revive under Julius II, who was a wild, fascinating man.
And he's the one who decided to build this new basilica.
He did. He was they call him the soldier pope. He was a soldier. He was an art patron. He was a very strong personality, and he hired Michelangelo, who was a very young sculptor, only 30 years old, to build a great mausoleum to himself. And Michelangelo this was going to be his masterwork, better than the David or the Pietà, which were the two works that he had done. And so he proposed this huge tomb statuary with larger-than-life statues, 40 of them. The thing would be three stories high. And then he went off to get the marble to build it. And Julius was thinking, where am I going to put this? Because there was no room for such a large edifice inside the old St. Peter's. So that was really what precipitated his decision to rip the old basilica down and build a new one.
So he wanted it simply so he could have space for his own tomb, but then he took the project away from Michelangelo.
That was the initial reason, but then he got so involved with building this beautiful basilica that he, and so expensive, that he lost interest in the tomb, and he was pouring all his attention and fundraising efforts into the basilica.
Now, how did the church raise the money for this huge project?
It was actually kind of interesting. It was not unlike a capital campaign today that Lincoln Center, say, or some nonprofit place would do. First, Julius asked the kings and princes throughout Europe to contribute, at which they all did. And then as he saw that it was going to take much longer than his lifetime, and he was also, oddly enough, very fiscally conservative. He had inherited a church that was bankrupt, and he built it up financially as well as every other conceivable way.
Was it his idea to come up with an annual fund that people could contribute to in exchange for a reduced sentence in purgatory?
It wasn't his idea. It was the idea of one of his bankers and a great friend of his. And he never actually put it into effect in that way. The way he began it, it was not money in exchange for redemption. It was you're just contributing the way you would contribute if you went to church. You were just making an annual contribution or whatever. But the popes who came after him misused it, really, and turned it into salvation for sale. And that was one of the triggers for the Protestant Reformation. That's what infuriated Martin Luther.
Well, then Martin Luther came to Rome around this time. But let's get back to the building itself. So he brings in the architect Bramante to design a building.
Yes.
And was it Bramante who came up with this massive structure that we now see at the Vatican?
No, it went through innumerable plans and architects. Bramante was a middle-aged man who hadn't really built that much. He had spent most of his young years in Milan with Leonardo da Vinci at the court of the Sforzas there in Milan. And then when they were routed by the French, he moved to Rome and discovered the Roman ruins and became fascinated by the huge structures that the Roman emperors had used to build. And the Pantheon, of course you can still see today, was very much intact. And he wanted to build a basilica that would be as beautiful as the ones the Roman emperors had built and have a dome as wonderful as the Pantheon dome crowning it. That was his dream, and Julius bought into that.
Well, you said that he hadn't had all that much of an experience as an architect. It seems like all the people who were brought in to provide some architectural input didn't have all that much experience. Later, Raphael, the great painter, was asked to to work architecturally. And then Michelangelo, isn't he pretty much credited with the final design? Michelangelo, the sculptor, painter?
Yes. He came in and really saved the building, which by then had gone through innumerable plans. And the last one that they were about to put into effect was really hideous. It looked like a wedding cake. There was all kinds of turrets and, oh, it was just wild looking. And by a fluke, the man who designed that, Da Sangallo, his name was, died before he could actually do it. And Michelangelo was an elderly man. And the Pope then, who was Paul III, called him in and really begged him to take over the project.
Now, he had already painted the Sistine Chapel.
He had painted the Sistine Chapel for Julius II.
Which he considered a punishment. He had expected to do that huge papal tomb, his masterpiece, and he wound up doing the frescoes, which he would have preferred to not have been asked to do?
He wasn't a painter. He didn't think of himself as a painter.
He was pretty good for a non-painter.
Exactly, and he did it with extreme ill will, with the assumption on his part that when he finished, he could then go back to the tomb. Unfortunately for him, Julius died just months after the Sistine Chapel was finished.
And when he died in 1512, did he feel confident that construction and funding would continue?
For the basilica.
Yeah, because by then, of course, there was a building. There was no going back, I imagine.
Yes, and the interesting part was the construction. Bramante constructed the basilica in a fascinating way. First of all, he began to tear down the old one, and there was such an outrage all through the Europe, the Christian world, that they had to stop. And he would only tear down the portion that he needed the space to build the new part of the basilica. So you had the old ruin still being used. Julius was saying Mass in the open air of the old basilica while it was also a construction site.
Does any of that old basilica still exist?
No, they salvaged one. The stone that all the Holy Roman emperors knelt on to be anointed is still there in the new basilica, and there's a column.
My guest is R.A. Scotti, S-C-O-T-T-I, her book, Basilica, The Splendor and the Scandal, Building St. Peter's, is now available in paperback from Plume. By the way, we want to thank our WNYC news department, which will be providing you with updates about disruptions in transit due to the storm throughout the day. I mentioned that Raphael wound up getting involved as an architect. Now, he was brought in to paint his famous frescoes when he was just 25. How did he become the chief architect?
The Pope who succeeded Julius, who was one of the Medici from Florence, was a young, relatively young man, and he and Raphael became good friends. They both liked to kind of have a good time. And so he promoted Raphael over many others that had more experience, but he gave him two older architects as partners, so it was kind of a triumvirate.
Did we see Raphael's hand in the finished work?
No, because he died very young, and he was really only the architect for a brief time.
Now, you mentioned Martin Luther's visit to Rome in 1511. That was a year before the death of Julius II. What did he find there? Because that, as you said before, played a role in his writing of his 95 Theses.
Yes, he found that Rome was very corrupt. It was a lot of abuses were going on. It was not a pious place for the seat of the church. And he was a very young monk, and he was completely disillusioned. And then when the popes were asking for huge amounts of money to build this gigantic basilica, he thought, one, that they could afford to use their own money to do it, and two, that they should be thinking more about saving the souls of the faithful than building this enormous edifice.
When his 95 Theses began circulating in Rome several years later, did anybody at the Vatican take notice?
Yes, some of the advisors to the Medici Pope Leo X, Julius was dead by then, tried to convince him that this was serious, something serious was happening. But this pope was, as I say, a Medici, and the Medici had lost Florence, and he was more interested in having his family back in power in Florence than in what was going on across the Alps. He was very much focused from Rome to Tuscany in his thinking.
Then Clement VII became pope in 1523. Was he also a Medici?
He was. He was the illegitimate son of Leo's.
Now, construction was at a standstill at that time. Was he chosen in hopes that he would resurrect the basilica?
No, they had an interim pope who was a reformer and very strict and no-nonsense kind of person. He was not for... He wanted to stop building the basilica. He wanted Raphael to stop painting the rooms in the Vatican Palace. He wanted everything to be very, very strict and stern. And he didn't live long, and when he died, the Italian cardinals, he was not Italian. He was from Utrecht. And the Italian cardinals said, never again a non-Italian, and they brought back the Medici.
And that was true until the 20th century.
Until John Paul II.
Although now we have a new tradition developing because we've had two non-Italian popes in a row.
That mindset left.
In 1527, Emperor Charles V's army invaded Rome. They killed thousands of people, destroyed two-thirds of the building in a siege that lasted 4 months. Why did he invade?
Again, this was more political than religious. Charles V was a very religious Catholic emperor. He controlled a huge amount of Europe.
That was the Holy Roman Empire, or the equivalent?
The equivalent, yes. And Clement VII was the Hamlet of the popes, I like to think of him. He could never make up his mind, and he had to decide whether to side with the French king, Francois I, or with Charles. His main concern was keeping Florence in the family. He made the wrong choice, sided against Charles, and Charles sent his army across the Alps, and there was no contest.
Well, it was pretty destructive. How did they wind up making peace?
It was shocking what they did, really shocking what they did in Rome, and they desecrated all. These were a lot of mercenary troops from Germany by then, which had a lot of Protestant princes. Again, it was political because without the Pope, the princes had complete authority before. When they were Catholic, they sort of owed allegiance, or their power came to them through the blessing of the papacy, of the church. So without that added thing, they were powers unto themselves. So it was really more political than religion. But anyway, their troops were many mercenaries. They came across the Alps, down the peninsula, and they hadn't been paid. So they just took whatever they wanted. They destroyed the city.
But in the end, things calmed down. And then Clement asked Michelangelo back to Rome to paint a Last Judgment scene at the Sistine Chapel.
Yes.
By now, Michelangelo is is reconciled to the fact that he's going to be seen as a painter as well as a sculptor?
No, he was never reconciled. He still fought it, but he was an extremely devout man and horrified by what was done in the sack of Rome. And his last judgment, if you've seen it, is over the altar in the Sistine Chapel. Is a really terrifying picture of the end of the world, eternal damnation or salvation.
I'm sure something that people who just gone through the destruction of Rome by Charles V's army could feel some kind of connection to.
Yes, and it was kind of to say, you know, this is what happens to people who behave like that. And so he did that kind of as because he couldn't not in his conscience. He accepted that.
The next pope, Paul III, was forced to take steps to deal with the fallout from the Reformation. What makes him such a pivotal figure in the story of the Basilica?
He was a fascinating character, I thought, because he was really, in his personal life and in his thinking, he was a very brilliant man and very intellectual on the one hand, but he also was fairly licentious. He had several children. But he was a pivotal person because in his life before he became pope, he kind of exemplified what was wrong, the corruption in the church. But when he became pope and saw what he had to do to reform the church, he did it with great skill and diplomacy.
And he had Michelangelo come up with a plan, first a model of the Basilica, then a plan, and then everybody agreed that they would not deviate from Michelangelo's plan, but of course they did.
Yes.
And it kept on going for how long?
Oh, it went after his death almost another 100 years.
What's amazing is that the building doesn't look like it's had all of these different people, you know, so many cooks making this one dish.
That is what's extraordinary about it.
Have any idea why? Is it because Bernini was brought in at the end? Did he just pull it all together?
I think that certainly helped. The piazza there and the colonnades when you're coming in give a sense of unity and all-embracing. And then the church itself, although Moderno, who was hired at the end to change Michelangelo's design and added the, when you go in that long aisle up to the main part, he added that, but he very carefully kept to the order that had been set by Michelangelo and Bramante. So he was, he's kind of maligned, I think, as an architect.
But the debates continued after the dome was raised. They were still debating the layout of the rest of the basilica, whether to use the Latin cross or the Greek cross. This was one of the most controversial buildings and, as you say, also played a role in the creation of the Reformation.
Yes.
And yet today, people only see it as a place you got to wait online forever to get into to see the Sistine Chapel.
Well, that's separate, really, not part of the Basilica itself. That was built before the Basilica.
That was the part that Michelangelo painted, his
yes.
two great paintings.
Yes.
But we do have the Basilica, and you provide some tours in your book as well. Basilica, the Splendor and the Scandal. Building St. Peter's is by R.A. Scotti and is now available in a paperback from Plume Publicity. I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
And I'll never be able to look at that building the same way again. I'm going to start looking for, that Raphael must have done that little thing. And, there's Michelangelo's hand. And, there's Giacomo della Porta's touch.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.